Good evening, everyone. This is part three of our introduction to Sefer HaKuzari. And where we left off last week, we're going to be discussing a new topic, but there was a lead-in, a segue, that I wanted to make sure that we're all part of. We had talked last week about the Khazars, the story of the Khazars, and how Rabbi Yehuda Halevi employs the story of the Khazars as a form of historical fiction in order to create an entertaining and engaging platform in presenting his what he feels are important Jewish theological ideas. That's really the extent of the importance for our purposes of studying the Khuzari, of what we need to know of the Khazars. However, the question that we left off with last week was, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi could have chosen any story, any two characters engaged in a dialogue, in order to be able to engage us in an interesting conversation or dialogue between two protagonists. Why specifically did he choose the story of the Khazars? What we're going to try and explore tonight is to try and unlock the answer to that question. And it's really going to be, in my opinion, very revealing as to the entire worldview of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi as to what role Judaism plays in our lives, as what role Torah plays in our lives. The first thing that will give us a clue as to what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi had in mind when he employed the story of the Khazars is that if we need to first look at the changes that he made to the original story as it appears in the Chasdai letters, which is the historical document that we discussed last week. If you recall, the story as it was recorded in the Chasdai letters from the Khazar King Joseph, the descendant of the original King Bulan, who converted to Judaism, who was corresponding and telling the story of the mass conversion of the Khazars to a great 10th century rabbinic figure named Chasdai ibn Shaprut. The story that he told him was that the king was visited in a dream by an angel who told him to seek out the proper way of serving his creator, and this prompted the king to summon three clerics of the three great Western faiths. He summoned a rabbi, he summoned a priest, and he summoned a qadi, an Islamic judge. And he had them dispute with each other, and over the course of time, he eventually realized that he was very drawn towards the arguments of Judaism and eventually converted to Judaism as a result. Now let's take a look. There are two very important and telling changes that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi makes to the original story from the Chasdai letters. Change number one is that instead of there being three protagonists, there are now four in the way that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi relates the story. And the fourth cleric is really not a religionist at all, but it's rather a philosopher. And not only is the philosopher added to this mix of clerics that have this disputation in the palace of the Khazar king, but it is the first of the clerics in Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's version that the Khazar king consults with to determine what he's supposed to do with his life, what the angel was trying to communicate to him. Now, why does Rabbi Yehuda Halevi change that and make that a part of his story? One of the things we have to realize is that the Khuzari, as we've discussed before, was a composition that was designed to, as the title itself suggests, to provide refutations and arguments in defense of the despised faith. That is the subtitle of the book, the Khuzari, to defend the despised faith. Why was Judaism called the despised faith? Why did Rabbi Yehuda Halevi give it that appellation? He did so because Judaism was under attack, or at least it was perceived to be under attack from the parent culture of the time. The parent culture in Andalusian Spain in the 12th century, and certainly leading up to the 12th century, was more philosophy than it was anything else, because the world at that time was so enamored by the intellectual attraction of Greek philosophy as it was interpreted and transported to this part of the world by the Islamic world. The Islamic world was viewed itself as the torchbearer of Greek philosophy. And so the world was steeped, at least in this part of Europe, was steeped in scholasticism and deep study. And there was a perception that Judaism had stagnated, had become stalled and sort of dropped off at the end of the Talmudic period and was not advancing in its intellectual growth. And this perception causes a number of Jews, perhaps, we can only speculate as to the numbers, causes a number of Jews to feel no longer excited about their Yiddishkeit, to no longer feel enamored, to feel that there's something more out there. There's perhaps a more universal message of humanity and intellect that I need to go outside of Judaism in order to find. That sound a little familiar, right? Isn't it interesting how, as much as things have changed, many things have stayed the same? And so that's actually one of the reasons why the Kuzari has such a contemporary feel to it, because it is actually defending Judaism against the external culture which presents itself as being so much more sophisticated and advanced by virtue of the fact that it represents itself as being modern. Whereas Judaism has never presented itself, has never packaged itself, never marketed itself as being something that has the latest new, brand new ideas. If anything, Judaism touts itself, the Torah touts itself as being the original, that which is immutable and unchangeable, and is not given to the winds of the changes of culture and time and the human attitudes and perceptions. And so this is really one of the reasons why Judaism is perceived as the despised faith. It doesn't have the same sophisticated language. It doesn't have the poetic ring as much as the Arabists of the time have. It doesn't have the sophistication of describing the world in such great detail and precision in the way that Aristotelian Neoplatonic philosophy does, which is the way the Muslims are able to present philosophy of their time. And so what Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi feels he needs to do is that put into the mind of the king that perhaps philosophy, this universalistic kind of endeavor that is embraced by all of mankind, maybe that's the way that I have to go. And if we read the dialogue that the Khazar king begins with the philosopher, we see that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi devotes a tremendous amount of space in giving the philosopher his voice, in presenting his argument, more space than he gives to the Christian cleric and to the Muslim cleric, who are dismissed relatively quickly. And as I may have mentioned to you before, many people who look at the Kuzari in a very cursory fashion and just read the first few pages get a false impression. They believe that the Kuzari is a polemic against Christianity and Islam in contradistinction to Judaism. That's actually very, in my opinion, a big mistake. Because if indeed Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's primary endeavor was going to be to argue why Judaism is superior to Christianity and Islam, he would have done a terrible job. Because if you really want to show that Christianity and Islam are false, you wouldn't devote a page to each in your entire book, which is what Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi does. He really actually dismisses them quite quickly, because that's not the major focus. Jews are not leaving Judaism in order to convert to Christianity. They're not leaving Judaism in order to be able to study the Quran. They're leaving Judaism en masse, perhaps, in order to be able to pursue philosophy. And so therefore, you may be ending up with people who are still part of the Jewish community, but whose ideas have changed, whose attitudes towards mitzvot and ritualistic kinds of things which have this archaic primitive ring to them may be lackluster. And that's why he has to really go ahead, head to head, and battle with the philosopher and explain that as sophisticated and as fanciful and as modern as his arguments sound, they actually are far inferior to the arguments of Judaism, which is based on a tradition that is rock solid and in many, many ways much richer, more robust, and far superior to the world of philosophy. So that's the first point we need to get across. But just bear in mind that this is a war that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is waging against the world of philosophy. And we also have to understand what philosophy is in Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's world. What is philosophy? Well, the word itself, philosophia, the love of knowledge, that in itself is really, when we boil it down to its most critical elements, that's really what Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is trying to combat. This love affair that people have with the intellect. And argues Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, that's never what Judaism was all about. When you think about it, the objective of philosophy and the objective of religion could be argued that they're two totally different things, but you could argue that they're actually one and the same. In Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's world, they are actually one and the same. Because whereas you and I might look at philosophy today as a subject or a discipline that we study in the university for a certain period amount of our lifetimes, and then we get real jobs and get serious about the real meaning of life after we've, you know, clouded our minds in the world of the abstract, right? And for some of us, for very few people, they become professional philosophers. But that's not what philosophy was back then. Philosophy was a way of life. The philosophers actually touted the fact that a person who devoted his life to the pursuit of knowledge was actually fulfilling his ultimate purpose in life. Because the purpose of humanity for the philosopher is the development of the intellect. The philosophers had developed, especially in the Islamic world in the medieval period, had developed a theory that had been based upon the writings of Aristotle, that the more one develops their intellect, the more of a perfected being they become. And the more of a perfected being one becomes, the more connected to what they call the prime cause, or God. And if you were perfected enough, that was your key to immortality. Because what is eternal life all about? Eternal life is the ideas that exist in your mind live on long after your body and soul have passed away. Because there is no eternity, said the philosophers, to the body, or even not to the soul. The only thing that is eternal are the ideas that are contained within your mind. So if you pass a certain threshold of perfected intellect, it is those ideas that will remain for all eternity in some kind of big pool of intellectual ideas that are contained in some dimension of great intellect. And there was a very, I'm simplifying it tremendously, but there was a very, very technical explanation of how a person is able to conjoin his mind to the great universal mind out there in the ether known as the active intellect, which is something that even many of the Jewish philosophers that we are very familiar with talk about as those who try to reconcile the philosophical model with the Jewish model, and they call it something called the Seichel HaPoel, which is really, again, a medieval concept which is a little bit strange to us in our modern understanding of the way we're supposed to act as Jews. But this was an attitude that was very, very prevalent. It was believed to be the science of its day. It was scientific fact for all that people knew, is that you want to be an eternal being, you want to live for all eternity, develop your mind. Increase the amount of ideas and the understanding that you have of God and his entire universe, and that's the key to immortality. So when you look at philosophy in that context, then you understand that this is more than just a discipline that is studied. It is a way of life. It gives a person a sense of purpose, that by engaging in this love of knowledge, I am actually realizing my potential as a human being and gaining eternal existence. It's huge. It's huge. Now, one might argue that sometimes disciplines in the university, even to this very day, extend themselves beyond being just disciplines of knowledge, of study, but actually become an objective unto themselves as a purpose or a way of life. And that's something that we have to be very careful of in making sure that even in the 21st century, our children don't find that the pursuits that they pursue intellectually in the university, whether for career purposes or whether to enrich their minds and their studies, they don't become in and of themselves their purpose for being, their raison d'etre, right? You understand? In other words, we send them off to college so that they'll become educated and they'll become enriched in their knowledge, but that they always have to maintain that my purpose of being is to be Jewish and to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But that's exactly the danger of pursuing the philosophy of the time, was exactly what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was concerned with. And so therefore, when the Khazar king, in this recreation of the dialogue from in the Kuzari, confronts the philosopher. The philosopher says to him, I can offer you a purpose of being. If an angel came to you and said that what you're doing is all wrong, then attach yourself to the ways of philosophy. And that's how you're going to find true meaning and true perfection. Now, that's the first thing that we have to realize in trying to understand Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's worldview, is that he is now choosing as his primary opponent to polemicize against is the world of philosophy. And related to that is the second way that I feel, the second major change that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi makes to the story that appears in the Chasdai letters. And that is, he puts words into the mouth of the angel that do not appear in the original account. The words that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi represents the angel as saying over and over again to King Bulan in his dream is, Kavanascha Ritsuya Eitzel Habore Avalo Ma'asecha. Your intentions are desirable to the Creator, but not your deeds. And that is the central sort of sentence that sets the framework for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's entire philosophy of religion. Your intentions are desirable, but not your deeds. And this, says Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, was what disturbed Bulan in his dream. So he decided to go to the shrines after getting this first communication from the angel and working even harder and trying to offer more incense and more sacrifices to the gods. But no matter how hard he endeavored, he would still be visited in this dream, and the angel would continually tell him, Kavanascha Ritsuya Eitzel Habore Avalo Ma'asecha. Your intentions are desirable to Creator, however, not your deeds. What is Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi trying to communicate to us by making this the central sentence that the angel is communicating to Bulan? And I believe that it goes to, again, his argument with philosophy. Because when you look at a very elaborate argument that is laid out by the philosopher to King Bulan at the very beginning of the Kuzari, the king is able to dismiss all of the arguments of the philosopher with one very simple argument. Besides the fact that I don't find, for a number of other reasons, your arguments convincing, there's one thing that I know. When I had my dream, the angel told me that my deeds count. It was my intentions that were very good, but I'm doing something wrong. You, as the philosopher, tout and promote a way of life whereby specific action, specific behavior, is not important. As a matter of fact, the philosopher is quoted in the Kuzari as saying that it really doesn't matter what way of life, what religious modality you choose to perform, because they're all good, as long as they bring you to intellectual perfection. If you want to go to the church, that's fine, as long as at the end of the day, your intellect is perfected through the meditation and prayers of the church. If you want to go to the mosque, that's also fine. You want to shape a lulav, that's also fine. But understand that all of these are merely means to making you into a greater intellectual being. So to that, the king says, does it make sense? Because the angel was telling me just the contrary. The angel was trying to tell me that there is a very specific mode of behavior that I need to subscribe to. No matter how well-intentioned I am, no matter how much my mind is connected to God, that's not the solution. The solution is not good intentions. The solution is not an intellectual commitment to my Creator, but rather it is what I choose to do with my body, how I behave. And as a result, that is where Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is communicating to us that as part of his polemic against the world of philosophy, he is emphasizing that Judaism is a religion of deed more than it is of creed. Judaism demands behavior, a commitment of the body, more than it demands a commitment of the mind. It's all very well and good to harbor certain beliefs in your heart. But in order to be a good Jew, you have to do the mitzvos. It's not, with a life, a Jew without mitzvos is completely devoid of any religious meaning or expression. And this is the exact opposite message of the philosopher. And I guess at this point, it's worthwhile for us to look back and sort of reflect on the fact that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi most probably came to this kind of emphasis in his discussion of Judaism based upon what he perceived as the necessary war that he needed to engage in with the world of philosophy. He needed to emphasize the fact that whereas philosophy says that particular physical performance, how you live your life, is really not where it's at, he has to point out that adarabba, pum fakert, Judaism is all about what you do with your life, how you live your life, how you move your arms and how you move your legs and how you move your mouth. That's really what counts. That's really what HaKadosh Baruch Hu demands of us. And you know, it's interesting because Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi takes a particular approach to defending Judaism against its detractors in the secular outside society. And there are many ways, many approaches that individuals might have in order to try and defend Judaism against an external society that is alluring and offers an alternative. As a matter of fact, we might even be able to point to some of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's contemporaries who took a totally different approach to how to defend Judaism. Whereas Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi digs in his heels and says, no, we're going to create a mechitza between philosophy and Judaism. They are a complete diametric odds with each other. There are other great Jewish thinkers who take a different approach, and their attitude is, philosophy is great. There are certain parts or aspects of philosophy that may alienate a Jew from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and those are the parts that need to be jettisoned and rejected. But overall, philosophy as a discipline is actually very consistent with Judaism. As a matter of fact, you might even argue that the knowledge and wisdom that philosophers promote today is actually part of Torah. And indeed, a great thinker that is a contemporary of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, lives about a half a century after him, but their lives overlap, is the Rambam, is Maimonides. And the Rambam devotes not only an entire book to Greek philosophy, reconciling philosophy with Judaism in the Morena Buchim and the Guide for the Perplexed, which he writes towards the end of his life, but even in his Mishneh Torah, which is his magnum opus on Jewish religious practice, how a Jew is supposed to live his life according to halakha, the very first four chapters of the Mishneh Torah are dedicated to an exposition on metaphysics and physics as he understands them based on the writings of Aristotle and the interpreters of Aristotle in the Arabic world. And that's truly astounding. How can the Rambam, who is the great codifier of Judaism, sort of can take this adulterated knowledge and incorporate it in his work on halachic practice? What is it doing there? And the Rambam says very simply that philosophy is part of the world of Judaism. And not only that, but it is a necessary prerequisite to an engagement in the world of Torah. He writes that the famous Mishnah in Chagiga, which talks about Tiyul Bapardes, talks about strolling through the orchard, and talks about how dangerous potentially that may be. The conventional understanding of Tiyul Bapardes, strolling through the orchard, if you're familiar with that famous story in Chagiga, Arba'a Shenichnasu Lapardes, there were four great rabbis who entered into the orchard, and three of them left and either died, went insane, or became apostates as a result of this strolling through the orchard, and only Rabbi Akiva was able to emerge unscathed. When you look at the Gemara, it appears that the Gemara is talking about an engagement with Jewish mysticism, esoteric knowledge that is quite deep, and a deep introspective understanding of the mystical underpinnings of this universe. But the Rambam understands what that Tiyul Bapardes means, philosophical speculation, and that the rabbis had always engaged in philosophical speculation because it is necessary to understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his universe in order to be a good Jew. The philosophers basically took esoteric knowledge that had been originated by Moshe Rabbeinu as passed down from generation to generation, and had taken it for many components of that for themselves, had repackaged it and organized it and gave it a whole new different language and in some ways distorted it. And so, unfortunately, because it is an esoteric tradition that largely has been miscommunicated or lost within the Jewish tradition, we sometimes have to study from the Aristotelians in order to understand a tradition that has really always been a part of Judaism. And therefore, for the Rambam, understanding philosophy makes you a good Jew because it's really part of Talmud Torah. It's part of the study of Torah. It's part of authentic Judaism. And the only thing that needs to be clarified for the Rambam is, let's make sure we excise those parts of Greek philosophy that are really the mistaken parts, the parts that are not really authentic Judaism, the parts that argue against what we know to be the basic tenets of our faith. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi does not accept that. It is true that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi does believe that whatever great wisdom in the areas of science and the correct aspects of philosophy did originate, many of them did originate in the court of King Solomon, because Rabbi Yehuda Halevi also writes that at some point, the great wise men of the ancient world all came to King Solomon's court and they plagiarized all of the science and knowledge that King Solomon had. They transcribed it, brought it back to their respective kingdoms, and then passed it off as their own original pieces of wisdom and scientific knowledge. But at the same time that he says that, he also argues that Judaism is not about mind, it's not about creed, but it's about deed. And that's his way of distancing the Jewish soul from the dangers of philosophy. Whereas the Rambam says, it's okay to dance with the philosophers, you just have to be very careful. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's approach is, stay away. It's not going to help you, it's only going to confuse you. Whereas the Rambam says, in order to be a complete Jew, in order to be able to have a sense that you have really accomplished your purpose in your life according to the Torah, you need to understand God not just based on a tradition that was passed down to us from Moshe Rabbeinu, but you also have to be able to understand God with your mind intellectually. That is to say, it's not just enough for the Rambam to say, Torah tzivalanu Moshe morashaki hilat Yaakov, that we have the Torah as a tradition and we will follow our Mesorah, we will follow a tradition that was passed down to us. That's only for the feeble-minded, says the Rambam. A Jew who is of greater intellect and was granted a mind that is capable of speculating about God intellectually and of going out into the world and examining the world around him and discovering HaKadosh Baruch Hu and discovering the wisdom of creation all around him, if an individual squanders that and just stays in the Beis Midrash studying the traditional texts, the Rambam says that that person has wasted his life and wasted his opportunities. God gave you a mind, and it was your responsibility to use it to properly speculate about that all of existence. For Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, it's precisely the opposite. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave you a Torah. He gave you a Mesorah, he gave you a tradition, he gave you the traditional texts. These texts may not present themselves as being as sophisticated as the texts of the philosophers, but you'd be making a mistake to think that they're not sophisticated. If anything, they're far deeper. And the reason that they're far deeper is because they are based on a first-hand, face-to-face encounter with God himself. And no philosopher's speculation, no intellectual power will ever be able to trump that kind of revelatory experience. And so for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, not only does philosophy pale by comparison to Torah, but it's dangerous to engage in that dance with philosophy. Because if you do, you'll end up becoming confused. And you may end up leaving the faith as a result, because the mind will only take you so far. There's a beautiful analogy that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi gives to try and compare the prophet and the philosopher. And this is the dichotomy that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi sets up to tell us that the tradition of prophecy that we have is far superior to any philosophical tradition that may be passed down to us from the great Greek philosophers. And I'm going to contemporize the analogy so that you'll get an idea of the flavor of where Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is coming from. Because in his analogy, he talks about the sophistication of philosophical writings versus the somewhat provincial kind of very hokey language that is used sometimes by the prophets in Tanakh. And the question that he asks is, why is it that if the Nevi'im, the words of the Nevi'im are so much more profound and meaningful and divine than the words of the philosophers, that they don't come across as being as sophisticated and intellectually satisfying as the writings of the great Greek philosophers? So Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says, I'll give you an analogy, and I'm going to contemporize it because many of us can relate to this. How many of you, years ago, Et Chata'ai Ani Mazkir Hayom, I once saw a movie. It was called Amadeus. Anyone ever see the play or the movie Amadeus? Okay, so the basic thrust of the story goes like this. That there's a great conductor who's the darling of the palace. His name is Salieri, and he's a great composer, and he's a great musicologist, and he gives very sophisticated lectures about music and about this chord and that chord and the way that the keys are structured and the way the notes are structured, etc., etc. One day comes along this brash, young punk by the name of Mozart, and he sits down at the piano and starts playing. And the music that comes out, it just touches everyone's heart in a way that Salieri's music just, there's no way that Salieri, and you just have to listen to it for 30 seconds and you know that Salieri is no Mozart. And this drives Salieri insane. But the truth of the matter is that if you were to ask Salieri, can you explain to us the science of music? He would be able to give you a 3-hour lecture on the science of musicology and be able to break it down in a very, very sophisticated manner. Now you call up Mozart and say, Mozart, can you explain to us the art or the science of musicology? And Mozart would probably tell you, I don't know, I just hear sounds in my head and I play them. You see, when someone is a true protege, when someone is a true gifted artist, they may lack the language that a sophisticated philosopher possesses in order to be able to present the information in a very sophisticated, very slick, packaged way. But that should not be mistaken for the authentic article. Because the function of the words of the Nevi'im is not to impress, but it's rather to inspire. It's to connect to your neshama, it's to connect to your soul. And therefore, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's whole attitude is that while you may study the texts of the Torah and may not find that slick sophistication, but what you will find is something that is going to connect and ignite your soul. And that's something that no philosophical text will be able to do. The words of the Navi are based on a picture, and a picture is more valuable than 1,000 words. The picture of the Nevi'im far outshines the words of the philosophers. And that's basically the approach that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi takes throughout his work. And that goes back, and that's really foreshadowed by his whole statement that he presents from the angel, Kavanascha Ritzuya Eitzel Habore Avolo Ma'asecha. Your intentions are desirable to the Creator, but not your deeds. This is a war against philosophy. For Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the Ma'aseh HaMitzvot, the mitzvot that I perform with my body, have such precision to them because they were given to us by HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. God gave us a set of commandments to perform with our bodies, that if we do them, we create some kind of supernatural resonance with the cosmos, and we create this amazing tikkun, this amazing rectification of the universe, both outside of ourselves and inside of ourselves. And that's not something that philosophical speculation can do. The key to eternity and to immortality for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is therefore not the perfection of the intellect, but it's rather the performance of the mitzvot.
Excuse me.
Bless you. The analogy that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi gives in order to illustrate this idea is that he, at the very beginning of the Sefer HaKuzari, somewhere in the first Ma'amar, he gives the following parable. He says, let's say we had a fellow who stumbles across a doctor's office one day, a doctor's clinic. And he sees that in this clinic, people are lining up to get medicines, medications that they hope will cure them of whatever malady they're suffering from. And he sees everyone's lining up, and they come into the clinic empty-handed, and they come out of the clinic with some kind of vial or medicine. And it seems to the doctor seems to be getting a lot of business, and he seems to be curing and helping a lot of people. So the guy says, this looks pretty easy. He says, I could be doing the same thing. So one day he breaks into the clinic, and he opens up shop when the doctor's on vacation, and he says, everyone can come to me and I'll dispense the medication. Well, he has no idea what medicines work for which kinds of illnesses. So he ends up giving medicine willy-nilly to different kinds of people. He gives the diabetic, high blood pressure medication, and he gives the person with high blood pressure, he gives them diabetes medication, and he ends up mixing everything up. And as a result, some patients die, some patients get violently ill, and maybe a couple of people he got lucky with, and he ends up curing. So Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says, this was what life was before the giving of the Torah. Mankind simply did not understand the complexity of this universe and the many, many different layers of spiritual essence that exist behind the veil of our physical reality. And so they could only use their intellects to try and deduce what we're supposed to do with our lives and how we're supposed to live our lives. He says, but that all changed when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the Torah. When God gave us the Torah, He gave us the prescription from the only doctor who is truly an expert in all of the ways of the world, because God created the world. He knows every single complex layer that exists beneath the surface of the physical universe. And therefore, every mitzvah that is given to us with absolute precision. And that's why when you look at the Torah and you find that the dimensions of the Mizbeach have to be specifically this much, and the korban has to be this bull of this age, or this sheep for that kind of atonement of that age, and you have to sprinkle the blood over here and not over here, and you have to do the mitzvah this way and not that way, and there seems to be a great amount of just completely indiscriminateness as far as why I have to do the mitzvah this way, not that way. It doesn't seem to make any sense. Why does mitzvah have to be done with such precision? So Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says, doesn't medication require precision? If the doctor prescribes 1 gram or one even milligram sometimes, too much or too little, he could kill the patient. So why would you think that God's precision of mitzvot requires anything less? That's why the mitzvot are prescribed the way that they are. Everything has a purpose and a function. And just to give you that dialectic comparison, I want to just compare that to the Rambam's perspective, which will conclude, because with this we'll understand that the Rambam's whole worldview, which is much more engaged and integrated with the world of philosophy, the Rambam places much more emphasis on the benefits of having an intellectual understanding of Torah and Judaism and God than Rabbi Yehuda Halevi does. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says, the world is too complicated, it's too complex, the mind simply can't grasp it all. And therefore, all you can rely on is the tradition. The Rambam says, no, God gave you a mind to understand these things. And so therefore, the Rambam's approach as to the why that so many mitzvot have so many minutiae of precision is a totally different approach. The Rambam actually bases himself on a midrash. The midrash states something very bizarre. Rav Amar lo nitznu, this is in Bereshit, Rabbah Mendalid Aleph. The reason why God gave us mitzvot was in order to purify His creations. What does God care? Whether you slaughter the animal from the nape of the neck or from the front of the neck. You think God really cares? He says, Havi lo nitnu ha-mitzvot ela l'saref v'henet ha-briyot. This indicates to us that God only gave us these very, very precise instructions in order to purify us. So the Rambam says, what does that mean? What is this midrash supposed to be telling us? So the Rambam says something very bold in the Mor Nebuchim in the third section in chapter 26. He says that in reality there's purpose and meaning to every single mitzvah. But the details of every single mitzvah sometimes are indiscriminate. And God only chose to sprinkle the Mizbeach seven times this way, or that animal, or this animal, because he needed to have some consistent rule for everybody. So in the Torah, he writes specific rules so that we'll be able to know how to live our lives, because we all need to worship God in a uniform fashion, so that it shouldn't be a haphazard kind of religion where you're doing one thing, I'm doing the other thing. But the reality isn't, that doesn't mean to say that the mitzvot themselves don't have purpose. Every one of the 613 has purpose. But the details of, the precision of the details for the Rambam is not really, he says it's an exercise in futility to try and understand the precision of all of the mitzvot, why the details are given in the way that they are. For Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, that's sacrilege, what I've just shared with you from the Rambam. So this is really the beginning point for us to understand this great dialectic that exists in this world that is trying to come to grips with the world of philosophy. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi takes an opposing approach and says, let's appreciate Judaism for what it is and not try to apologize to the world of philosophy and try to integrate and reconcile. And the Rambam says, no, the world of philosophy is real. It's real Torah. It's something that comes down to us as a true tradition, and it's reconcilable. It's part of what we're meant to do. And now we have to try and understand how this is relevant to our own lives. And we'll continue this discussion here next week. Have a good night. Please go to your sessions.